The Gary Knoll Show, weekdays at noon Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, lots of positive information, the latest on how ignorance is bliss when it comes to challenging social issues. Then we're going to take a look at too much undeserved self-praise can lead to depression. And then green tea, what it does if you don't want to get a flu vaccine, it can help you. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. We're going to do one question only for today. This is going to be an ongoing series of special reports. Are vaccines safe? That's it. I'm going to ask her one question, let her take all the time she wants to answer it. Then coming in the next day or two, I will be doing an original in-depth investigative report on the ingredients in vaccines. This is the most comprehensive study that you will find anywhere in the world literature. But it's very important for those of you who believe that vaccines have caused injury but couldn't prove it. Now you'll be able to see the toxicology of what each ingredient will do, can do in combination. So that's coming. Also, another in-depth original investigative report on the politics of cancer, why we have lost the war on cancer and cannot possibly win it until we understand that the politics we see of special interest groups permeating Wall Street has been there long before that in the medical industrial complex. That report, so two original in-depth investigative reports coming at you later this week. Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, a physician who incorporates integrative medicine into her practice, will talk about vaccines. She is the author of Flu and Flu Vaccines. Then, also today, our issue of the day is an open letter to Chancellor Linda Katehi from one of the teachers at the University of California, Davis, assistant professor in the Department of English, and why he wants her to resign. And then I'll open that up for others to give their comment on. We have a lot to share. Let us begin. This is from Mainstream Science, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, and it says the following. The less people know about important complex issues, such as the economy, energy consumption, and the environment, the more they want to avoid becoming well-informed. And the more urgent the issue, the more people want to remain unaware. That's according to this. Quote, these studies were designed to help understand the so-called ignorance is bliss approach to social issues. And this was from the professor at the University of Waterloo in Ontario. The findings can assist educators in assessing significant barriers in getting people involved and engaged in social issues. All right, a few thoughts on this. Having been involved my entire life, adult life, from a teenager on in social issues, I've always been perplexed about who will come forward and address an issue, even who wants to know the truth of an issue, or are people comfortable where they're at in their belief systems. And I believe that it's multifactorial. I believe part of the answer is that certain life energies tend not to go forward unless they can see that the leadership within their tribe has, or guild, or group, or family has been threatened in some way with its survival or its comfort. Then it will speak up, but only on that issue and only to the degree that they have something specific they'll deal with, and then they recede again. So it's not like someone awakens to see that slavery is wrong or the drugging of our children is wrong and then becomes aware of all the other wrongs. It just doesn't work that way. I also believe, and the most common avoiders of social issues are the adaptive supportive life energies, and yet they represent almost 85% of the total population. The ones most likely to engage are the creative assertives and the dynamic assertives. They will set the stage for the issues, guide them, and then be supported by other energies. I also believe that it has a lot to do with what a person's own conditioning has been. Did they come from a very proactive family or not? A lot of people grew up in the kind of more socially conservative environment where you didn't speak out and you didn't draw attention to yourself, because frequently there could be a consequence to it. So one of the reasons that we are very ignorant, it is by intent. We choose not to know the likely outcome of our lifestyle, our choices in life. If we did, it would scare us. Well, then we're put between our conditioned beliefs. You were conditioned to believe if you work this job, have this relationship, have this number of kids, live in this environment, you will have this outcome. Well, that hasn't worked in 30 years. So what if I did everything I'm supposed to do to be a good citizen, but I'm still not a happy person? Then they say, okay, if you're not really happy in life, most of us aren't, so adapt a tolerance for things, and here are some ways that you can ease that discomfort to make your adaptability a more encouraging. Alcohol, television, distraction, being a voyeur to everyone else's challenges and fights. And so it became an enormous market. The I'm not happy with my life, so service my pain. And we have all these products and so-called faux experts, like Oprah, who I consider the queen of dysfunction. And she was perfect for her audience. She was as dysfunctional as them, and all the promises of the secret and all it did is make her a billionaire, and no one got any better because of it. But a lot of people's reputations were made because of promising things that really have to be approached in a different way. But everyone played the game. And because everyone was playing the game, they didn't see how much of a game they were in. The Dr. Phil, all these shows, the reality shows, none of this helps anybody except those people who've learned how to commodify it. Commodifying dysfunction, commodifying a person's pain, gives you an unlimited opportunity to exploit that market, because it's never going to change. And hence, when people get on drugs or medication, they start watching something, doing something, they just finish that the rest of their life. In fact, that's one of the reasons very few people actually read original nonfiction books after they graduate from college. Very few things change after college. The most formative years are when we're growing up and until after college, and then suddenly we meet the real world. Well, then what happens if the real world doesn't meet your expectations, doesn't give you the same kind of latitude and fawning acceptance that your parents do, and looks at you in the same way it looks at everyone else, without that special gleam? What do you do? How do you cope? More often than not, you don't. You get angry, nothing happens, you get depressed, in some level of depression, and then you function by adapting. And then you just try to go through each day and hide the pain. Keep busy. That's a good way to do it. If you don't have a life, have some more kids. That's a great way to do it. Live through your children. If you've already have your kids and you're an empty nest, live through your grandkids. That's another way to do it. Boy, do we really do some stupid things and we're not aware of it. But then some people wake up for whatever reason. Maybe it's their heart attack or stroke. Maybe it's the breast cancer. Maybe it's the divorce. Maybe it's the home foreclosure. Maybe it's being outside looking at a house you used to live in and now you're in a car and you have no place to go. And then suddenly you realize, how did I get here? Can I stop blaming the world and take responsibility for what I've done? That's when everything starts to change, and that's where you see life for just what it is. And no one woke up at 5 o'clock this morning with the sole intent of pissing you off. So don't look at everyone as if they're the enemy and triangulate. Your problems are only existing because someone else made them for you. No, we did it ourselves. We elect the people to office. We buy the products that causes diabetes and heart disease. We buy the houses we can't afford. We build them in places like earthquake zones and hurricanes and tornado alley and the side of cliff and up in the woods until there's a fire. And then we don't seem to be able to get anything out because we waited too late because we couldn't believe that it could actually happen to us. Because how in the world could we have been that dumb to have built a house without any thought of what happens if there's a downside to this decision? This euphoric, excessive optimism gets us into so many problems. We just never had a reality check. And the first reality check is generally when something hits us down really hard. But then if you get back up, then you realize almost everything you've been doing has not been in alignment with your authentic self. And it's only what you do that's authentically aligned to the real self that allows you to go forward. Then you can get balanced. Then you can start to do it over again. Then you begin the next part of your life with a whole lot of strength and insight and sensitivity and forgiveness and smartness. You're not going to make the same mistakes twice. That they left out of this article. But to the degree that they got it right, that most people live in denial and they just don't want to know. You show them an issue they are uncomfortable with because it could give them a truth they're not willing to see, they will deny it. And that's why we have so much dysfunction in our society at every level. Now, too much undeserved self-praise can lead to depression. This is from an interesting article from the American Psychological Association, published in the peer-reviewed journal Emotion. Here's what it says. Quote, people who try to boost their self-esteem by telling themselves they've done a great job when they haven't, dude, let's say about 99.99% of all people under the age of 35, all right, the narcissism is just, it is palpably thick. Well, then they can end up feeling dejected. The little boo-boo, Paul, what you going to do? And instead, according to new research published, the high and low performers felt fine when they were assessing themselves accurately. Probably because the high performers recognize their strengths and low performers acknowledge their weaknesses and could try to improve their future performance. But you got to be honest. That's the key. If you're honest to look at what you do and ask yourself on a scale of 1 to 100, where am I really performing? And what's preventing me from trying it differently? Is it discipline? Is it understanding? Is it rigidity? Is it freedom of expression? Is it releasing this energy and allowing that energy to unfold in a different way? Is it structure, being too structured, needing control, needing to control the outcome? You need to control the outcome of everything. You've just lost the game. Because we can't control the outcome. We can't control other people, and we shouldn't even be trying. Be honest. Where are you at in your own efforts of life? And more often than not, what happens is that the standards have been set so low that people who do anything suddenly want to be rewarded for it, and therefore we just have this whole phenomena of self-praise or expected adulation from other people for just showing up. And wonder why the greatest generation, those who are still alive, look on with a quiet and understanding mind. Gee whiz, there was a time when people actually had to master life, not just some specific skills. So if you want to feel good about yourself, be honest about yourself. And finally here, in the health nutrition segment, green tea supplements better flu fighter than a vaccine. I'll quote this from Ethan Evers, Natural News. Flu season is now in full swing and seasonal vaccinations are being pushed from every corner. Nonetheless, a recent clinical trial showed that green tea-based supplements reduced the risk of flu by 75%. That is far better than the 60% risk reduction recently reported in The Lancet for vaccinations. Given that green tea provides a host of other health benefits and no risks of injection, it would appear to be far superior alternative. And then it's specific. For many years, it was known that green tea polyphenols actively suppress many bacterial and fungal and viral species. On the virus front, green tea suppresses adenovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, herpes simplex, HIV-1 and influenza viruses, and EGCG, one of the main polyphenols in green tea, is mainly responsible for this suppression. Specifically, ECGC binds to the molecule that is in turn bound to the influenza virus, which blocks it from attacking and infecting target receptor cells. And EGCG also alters the virus cell membrane, which further inhibits its ability to infect other cells. And another important component of green tea is the amino acid L-theanine, which has been shown to activate human gamma delta T lymphocytes to proliferate, make interferon gamma, a potent antimicrobial cytokine. And these lymphocytes are considered to be the body's first line of defense against infection. And green tea, therefore, offers a two-pronged protection from the flu. And what I'm always suggesting to people is first use your green tea at about 1,000 milligrams a day in divided doses, but then take colloidal silver during that two-week period at about 200 parts per million, and then wild oregano oil with quercetin at 4,000 to 5,000 milligrams and vitamin C at 5,000 to 10,000 milligrams, and you have really supercharged your lymphatic system and also helped your lymphocytes. Now, one early trial using green tea against the flu involved gargling three times daily with a weak solution of green tea, and that was only 50 milligrams of catechin per cup. The theory was that since the throat was a major infection site for influenza, gargling could stop the flu virus there. And the theory was right. They had a substantial reduction in the green tea of those that did it versus the placebo group. So, made a difference. So, less illness by 75% if you have over 400 milligrams of green tea a day. I'm suggesting a little higher than that. I'm suggesting 1,000 milligrams. And one last thing, the omega-3 fatty acids, DHA, improves insulin resistance and boosts cardiovascular health. And this was a good study in Nutrition Review. So if you want to help your heart, if you want to be less susceptible to cardiovascular disease, 2,000 milligrams a day of omega-3 fatty acids. This was a Danish study of over 3,200 individuals over 23 years that showed the benefits of the omega-3 fatty acids. So, lots of good stuff happening from health and nutrition. I'm Gary Knoll. Now to our issue of the day, then I'm going to come back and take your calls on this. And this is a letter. And the letter is from Nathan Brown, Assistant Professor, Department of English, Program in Critical Theory, University of California, Davis. I'll quote it. This is to the Chancellor. I'm a junior faculty member at the University of California, Davis. I'm an Assistant Professor in the Department of English, and I teach in the Program in Critical Theory and in Science and Technology Studies. I have a strong record of research, teaching, and service. I'm currently a board member of the Davis Faculty Association. I've also taken an active role in supporting the student movement to defend public education on our campus and throughout the University of California system. In a word, I'm the sort of young faculty member, like many of my colleagues, this campus needs. I'm an asset to the University of California, Davis. You are not. I write to you and to my colleagues for three reasons. One, to express my outrage at the police brutality which occurred against students engaged in peaceful protests at the University of California, Davis campus. Two, to hold you accountable for this police brutality. And three, to demand your immediate resignation. Today you ordered police onto our campus to clear student protesters from the quad. These were protesters who participated in a rally speaking out against tuition increases and police brutality on University of California campuses on Tuesday, a rally that I organized and which was endorsed by the Davis Faculty Association. These students attended that rally in response to a call for solidarity from students and faculty who were bludgeoned with batons, hospitalized, and arrested at University of California, Berkeley last week. In the highest tradition of nonviolent civil disobedience, those protesters had linked arms and held their ground in defense of tents they set up inside Sproul Hall. in a gesture of solidarity with those students and faculty, and in solidarity with the National Occupy Movement, students at the University of California set up tents on the main quad. When you ordered police outfitted with riot helmets, brandishing batons, and tear gas guns to remove their tents today, those students sat down on the ground in a circle and linked arms to protect them. What happened next, without any provocation whatsoever, other than the bodies of these students sitting where they were on the ground with their arms linked, police pepper-sprayed students? Students remained on the ground, now writhing in pain, with their arms linked. What happened next? Police used batons to try to push the students apart. Those who could be separated were arrested, kneeling on their bodies and pushing their heads into the ground. The police continued. Those they could not separate, they pepper sprayed directly into their face, holding these students as they did. When students covered their eyes with their clothing, police forced open their mouths and pepper sprayed down their throats. Several of these students were hospitalized. Others were seriously injured. One of them, 45 minutes after being pepper sprayed down her throat, was still coughing up blood. This is what happened. You are responsible for it. You're responsible for it because that is what happens when University of California chancellors order police onto our campuses to disperse peaceful protesters through the use of force. Students get hurt. Faculty get hurt. One of the most inspiring things, inspiring for those of us who care about students who assert their rights of free speech and peaceful assembly, about the demonstration in Berkeley on November 9th, is that University of California Berkeley faculty stood together with students, their arms linked together. Associate Professor of English, Celeste Langdon, was grabbed by her hair, thrown to the ground, and arrested. Associate Professor Joffrey O'Brien was injured by baton blows. Professor Robert Haas, former poet laureate of the United States, National Book Award, and Pulitzer Prize winner, was struck with a baton. These faculty stood together with students in solidarity, and they too were beaten and arrested by the police. In writing this letter, I stand together with those faculty and with those students they supported. 1 week after this happened, University of California, Berkeley, you ordered police to clear the tents from the quad at University of Davis campus. When students responded in the same way, linking arms and holding their ground, police also responded in the same way, with violent force. The fact is, the administration of University of California campuses systematically uses police brutality to terrorize students and faculty, to crush political dissent on our campuses, and to suppress free speech and peaceful assembly. Many people know this. Many more people are learning it very quickly. You're responsible for the police violence directed against the students on the University of California Berkeley campus on November 18th. As I said, I'm writing to hold you responsible and to demand your immediate resignation on these grounds. Your thoughts? Looking at the larger issue that we have become a militarized state. We are living in a fascist police state. Yes, you could still protest, but to do so, you will have yourself photographed. You will go on an enemies list. You will be cataloged. That's not a part of our constitutional right of free assembly and free speech. That's the police state that we're living in today. If we do not challenge this, if we do not protest, if we do not stand up, if we do not boycott, then what will be the next stage? How far will they go? That's my question. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment with your calls. Here's one other note. Chicago, from Carla Johnson. Cities with budget woes are selling out to the highest bidder. Seven vinyl banners draped this month along one of Chicago's most iconic bridges. Advertisements, some have dubbed a visual crime, and commercial graffiti are reviving a debate about how governments raise money in tough economic times. In the aftermath of the Great Recession, a public school district in Colorado is selling ads on report cards, and Utah has a new law allowing ads on school buses. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel's administration, straining to fill a $600 million budget hole, is looking to raise $25 million from ads on city property, including on bridges, electrical storage boxes, and garbage cans. Well, anything they can buy, any way they can make money, they're doing so. But not at all are they dealing with the actual underlying problems. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
days can be sunny with never a sigh. Don't need what money can buy. Birds in the tree sing their day full of song. Why shouldn't we sing along? Get that way. Look at what I've got. I got rhythm, I got music, I got my man. Who could ask for anything more? I got daisies.
Yeah, and she had talent, something few people today sing have, and charisma. And just a joy to behold, Judy Garland. I'm Gary Nall, and we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. About what should we do? 60% of Americans, according to a USA Gallup poll today, said they're neither for nor against the Occupy movements because they don't understand them. They don't understand what they're for and what they're against, hence they haven't made up their mind yet. Contrary to what Fox News, that makes up polls or uses polls that give it the results they want for their own political bias, most people are right now indifferent. Well, it's not just about the groups meeting, and now on campuses, it's about what would be the mistake of simply allowing people an opportunity to protest nonviolently to make their points. Yeah, that's your call. Give us a call. I'd like to hear what you have to say on this. Now for our special, before we go to a calls and into our studio in New York City, I have something I have not mentioned on the air. It's a major package. And this is the first time that I'm offering it to you. You're going to get a book, my brand new book, Death by Medicine, and a documentary, the multi-award-winning documentary. In fact, it's the most winning documentary in the world thus far this year. 56 international film festivals. Death by Medicine. Two together. That would normally be $40, $50, $60. $15. That's right. I wanted to make this package so that everybody could afford it. So you're getting the package, Death by Medicine. You're getting the book and the documentary for $15. Give a call, and I'll give you our number, and we'll send this right out to you. And it really shows you in depth the documentary about the dominant medical paradigm contributing to America's health crisis. The problem is the way we approach disease. The problem is the medicines and the medical paradigm itself. The kind of medications we get for different conditions, the fact that most don't work, the fact that most of science backing it up is not scientifically based medicine but proprietary medicine. The lobbyists that control this, I put this together piece by piece like a puzzle. It's very powerful, from the nation's medical schools teaching the wrong curriculum to the research, which is privately financed for the false drug clinical trials, the peer review scandal, the literature that is worthless, complicit federal agencies that are have no control because they've been taken over by the pharmaceutical interest. It's all here in the book and in the video. A documentary and a book, together, $15. Call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and ask for the multi-award-winning documentary, Death by Medicine, and the book. And you can have them for $15. That's it for today, just that. Death by Medicine, book and video. The book is a powerful book, fully documented and referenced and reviewed and researched by five PhD MDs. Now, I also want to say thank you to all the people. I got word when I arrived at a new filming location. By the way, for those of you up in Montreal, I'm going to be filming all day at the University of Montreal. But I heard that the movie theater last night that showed Death by Medicine at 9 o'clock and Knocking on the Door at 7 o'clock on the Lower East Side was packed, had to turn people away. Thank goodness, however, we were there and gave Richard Gale gave copies of the two films to those people who showed up at the door who couldn't get in. We had no idea that many people would try to get in because we've already had 20 sold-out showings. But everybody, I mean, it was just mobbed. So thank you. It was a great response. Happy to have that for you. Let's say hello to Edward from Brooklyn. Hi, Edward.
Yes, good afternoon. Listen, I just want to make this statement, not my main point, though, but a solution, in my opinion, is a theory that you have the power to implement. And if you don't have the power to implement your theory, then it's not really, in my mind, considered a solution. Now, the problem with the financial world, the financial world can't be the blame. The blame is the people in the position of power to write the laws that allow them to do what they're doing. So instead of the people focusing on Wall Street, the representatives of this republic, which that's where the focus should have been on. Now, I'm suggesting that a solution to this problem is that all of the groups focus on one particular state in this republic, say like New York, the biggest. Focus all the resources and removing all the people in power and electing those who represent the citizens of this republic. And then from that, using a New York example, New York State City as a template, then the biggest, one of the most powerful states in the republic, then I think that others will follow using that template. So if you, other members of the group, focus on this one particular state, and then work your way through state to state using New York as a template and ridding all the criminals out of office and, you know, electing those, you know, locally. Because this republic, the founding fathers already set everything up, you know, because they knew that people will be corrupt. They already knew that. So if we just learn the laws of the Republic of New York, we learned all the laws, and people like you and lawyers will explain to us what they set up already, like recalls and all that.
Okay, you've made several very valid points, and I thank you for sharing that. Let me add on to a few of your thoughts. First, you mentioned that the corruption is in those who have the power. I would agree with half that. You're familiar with the Nobel Peace Prize. She won it in 1991 for peace, Aung San Suu Kyi, right? In Burma, or Myanmar, which is what is and was Burma. She said it is not power that corrupts, but fear. The fear of losing power corrupts those who wield it. Look at BAI and Pacifica for that. And look at every major corporation and look at every legislator. And the fear of the scourge of power corrupts those who are subject to it. Look at all the police that are out there fighting against people who are actually fighting for their rights. What would happen if those same police refused to do anything that was not in the Constitution? Now, there's only one elected official who has power in the United States to actually deal with crime, and that is your county sheriff. No other officers elected. The police are not elected. The police commissioner is not elected. But the sheriff is, the only one. Marshals are not elected. If you start with one sheriff and you show that sheriff the Constitution and say, you take an oath to uphold the Constitution and the rights and the freedoms that are inherent explicit in the Constitution, then a lot of what is going down now to becoming a police state would not exist. Secondly, power exists in those who have managed to manipulate it. And how do you manipulate power? Through money. And how do you get the money? By falsely convincing someone that what you have to sell them is what they need for their life to be happier. Want to get a good look at people buying into a cancer and thinking that it was utopia? Look at the suburban sprawl and ugliness, congestion, deforestation, destruction of habitat, blight, and then stress for living there. But people made that their manna. Now look at those people who were convinced the only quality of life they could have is they could afford to be a part of that. It didn't work. So you have to withdraw your economic power. Your economic power is what gives them their political power, because without money, they have no political base. They buy their power by convincing lobbyists who they hire and allied group members and legislators that what they want is what is needed, and then they pay people to make sure that everyone gets a favor. Money is the favor. So if you take away the money from McDonald's and Burger King, and you stop paying tuition en masse, which I believe should be done by every student in America until there's a reform, completely reforming the student loan programs, forgiving all late interest and starting with a 2% interest that cannot be compounded or changed, and allowing bankruptcy to be changed so people could get out of that, then you start boycotting and taking away the power of investing. Stop investing. Make sure your pensions are not invested in anything that deprives people of a quality of life. Then you start withdrawing your support for politicians. All Democrats, all Republicans, don't vote either one. Then turn off their television radio programs. Now, do you realize how much power you have exercised when you've done that, especially when you do it with unity of a common cause? You can all have different backgrounds, you can all have different beliefs, but nothing will ever get done if you don't all pull on the same rope in a tug of war. You're constantly pulled off the side of the cliff by the other side, and then they control you. So join with groups that now exist, and then come together. Let's stop and close down nuclear facilities. Let's stop gas hydrofracking. Let's stop them from including extra taxes into the property owners in New York, New Jersey, and where we live. As long as you're not willing to take that sacrifice, they continue to have the power they have, and then your argument becomes correct. Thank you for your call. And let's go into studio and say hello to Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We have an email here from Ian from Australia. He says, excuse me just a moment.
Yes, Elizabeth.
Hello, sorry about that. He says that he married an American woman 4 years ago, and she had a child as a single mum. The child was age 6, and he was a very healthy young fella. As he was beginning school, he was required to have vaccines. His wife has been a listener of your show, and many times you've given the rationale as to why he should not be vaccinated. But working as a healthcare professional, she used her insight and knowledge that vaccines were safe, even when you stated this was irresponsible and dangerous. A few weeks later, they nevertheless agreed, and they have had their son vaccinated. Within 48 hours, the boy developed a very high fever and developed seizures and was hospitalized. He then developed autism spectrum disorder, and over the next 2 years, there was nothing in orthodox medicine over there that could help them. Finally, 2 years ago, he looked at your information in the DVD, Autism Made in the USA, and also Vaccine Nation, and he says that he's so angry with himself that he'd been closed-minded and so sure. He'd never considered the reality, but he thought that the vaccines were 100% safe. They put him on your protocol, and he's made a remarkable improvement. Once again, he can actually speak. He says they believe that he will regain his full capacities, and he wants you to know, and others know, what a painful lesson this has been to him. But his question is on a whole different area. He says, as a curiosity, they've moved to the countryside to do some sustainable gardening, and little did he know how many deadly creatures he'd have to live with. And he knows that all through your life you've lived on ranches and a farm in Texas and in hot places. And he says, how do you manage it? Because he can't go out into the bush and with no shoes on, because they can literally kill you. He says, how do you manage it?
He's from Australia?
Yes.
Okay, well, I've lived on a farm or a ranch my entire life. And what you have to understand is that you're living in an environment that you have to share with the natural creatures who are there. And in all the environments I have lived, there are creatures that can do you some harm. I remember tearing down a barn upstate New York in Stone Ridge, an old barn, and I jumped back because there was a brown reclusive spider behind one of the walls. You don't see them, but boy, if they bite you, there's no anti-venom for them. They can kill you. And down in Texas, You have to be very careful when you're planting because there's a little tiny snake. It's called a pygmy rattler. It's more deadly than a big rattlesnake, and it doesn't rattle before it strikes you. And there's also water moccasins, and there's copperheads. But what you have to do is first understand how can you minimize the risk to yourself and still enjoy your environment. And that's where you have to keep your grass cut low. You have to spread it with diatomaceous earth and on a regular basis, and that will get rid of a lot of that will get rid of the ticks and lice and fleas and spiders in that environment. You can't go out, for example, if you live in Arizona and just go out and sit on a lawn chair if you've got a desert out your backyard, because you're going to have black widow spiders, the black widow spider capital of the world. So why live in a place that is so hostile to you, either because the weather's too hot or too dry, or there are critters there that have adapted to that hot, dry, but you haven't, that you're not compatible. You have to live in compatibility with your environment. And that's the key. Do things smartly. For example, when I go out, I always put my pants, running pants or regular pants, inside my socks that are white. Why? Something's crawling up my leg. I can see it. If not, I couldn't. Think of all the people now living in the Northwest and in Vermont and Connecticut and New York who have Lyme's disease because they never thought that that little tick could get to them. But it got to the deer, then it dropped off the deer, got to the dog brought in the house, and people forgot to comb the dog, look in its ears before they allowed the dog in. Simple precautions. Now, in Australia, you're in a little different place because first you got the biggest sharks in the world, the great a white shark, which, by the way, contrary to what most people say, is not the big killer. It generally will only go after seals, but a surfer looks like a seal, and it kills in an unusual way. It comes in and takes one bite, then circles waiting for the person to bleed out, and then goes in and eats. Your more dangerous shark, which kills more people, is your bull shark, and that's a freshwater shark, meaning it's adapted to living in fresh water. It hunts in the rivers where a lot of people in Australia boat and swim and fish. It has smelling capacity 10,000 times greater than a human, and it can smell one drop of blood 3 miles away, and it has unique electrical current sensory monitors on its head that it can pick up any electrical vibration. And what are we? We're electrical energy. So it can pick you up and zoom in on you even in cloudy water. But that's still not the biggest killer in Australia. You have the deadliest snake in the world there, the inland taipan. And that is a real bad snake. Good news is it's very reclusive and non-aggressive. But when you're bitten, you will die, generally within 10 to 30 minutes. But because it will move away when it feels a vibration, it's not killing a lot of people. The snake that kills the most people is your eastern brown snake. It is the second deadliest snake in the world. In fact, Australia has 20 of the 25 deadliest snakes on the planet. It will kill you, and it's very aggressive. And it goes everywhere. You can find this critter slithering into your backyard over your fence, and it will go after you. It's like a black mamba. It'll go right after you, and it's too fast and you're too slow to get out of its way. And once it bites you, you just bleed to death because it stops the clotting factor. Stonefish is everywhere. It's considered the worst pain of any inflicted attack of any creature. There's no antidote to it. You're in the most excruciating pain. It looks like a stone, a little stone. You're in the ocean, you're walking, and boom, you step on it, and a spike goes into your foot. Oh. The biggest killer in Australia is the box jellyfish. Nice. It can kill you in 2 minutes. It has six eyes. It grows to be about 10 feet long with tentacles, but it has millions of tiny little barbs, and these fly off at 50 feet per second. That's 40,000 times the force of gravity. Millions of them hitting you. And you stop breathing.
Wow.
You get stuck with a jellyfish, the box jellyfish, you're going to die. And then you have your redback spider. It's everywhere and in people's homes. And you also have the most toxic spider, the funnel web spider, very aggressive. And then if you're out in the woods, you better be smart. Don't be an idiot. You go out into a camp, you must be armed, because there's one creature out there that can kill you, and does, and that's the dingo. That's about a 60-pound, 2-foot-high dog that is that has the capacity to know how to go through. It bites its prey where it can cripple it, and then goes in for the throat and crunches it. And then, of course, you've got your largest reptile, which is the 20-foot, 2,000-pound crocodile. A few things that can hurt you, but people have learned to be smart, and when they're smart, then they don't get hurt.
Right.
Thank you.
Fascinating creatures, though, I should imagine.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest, who is standing by. And I'm going to be asking Dr. Sherry Tenpenny one question. Are vaccines safe? I will stay quiet. She will take her time and answer this.
The whole issue of vaccine safety has been that we've always been told that vaccines are safe, but we've never really explored the other side. Are vaccines unsafe? Vaccine safety studies are short, they're inconclusive, they don't go on for a long period of time. All the studies are performed on children who are not ill, on no medications, and are by definition healthy. But once a vaccine is approved, it's been given to all children and all adults, even those who have been chronically sick and are on many different types of medications. So we really don't know until that happens what the true clinical trial is around safety. When I first started researching vaccination and looking at the whole concept of vaccine efficacy, because what always comes out is that vaccines are safe and effective, it took me a while to figure out what that word effective really even meant. We as clinicians and doctors and even parents and the lay public, when they hear the word effective, they assume that what that means when the phrase is said, vaccines are safe and effective, meaning that vaccines are safe and they will keep you from getting sick. But digging deeper into the scientific research, what I came to find out was that what effective really means is that a substance is injected into a body and it creates an antibody. And if an antibody response is generated by that shot, then the science says the vaccine is effective. It did what it was supposed to do. The shot created an antibody. There is a leap in assumption then that simply because you have the antibody, it will protect you and keep you from getting sick. And there's a lot of information out there that says that antibodies, we're not really sure what they really mean. Do the antibodies really mean that you are chronically sick? Does it mean you've had an exposure? You've had a certain level of protective antibody and you can still get sick. So the whole word in the scientific literature about effective vaccines means that you create an antibody, but that doesn't necessarily translate from effective into protecting you from getting sick. Recently, we have seen outbreaks of mumps and pertussis in the last couple of years. And in the mumps outbreak that happened in Iowa about 2 or 3 years ago, we found that 67% of the children who contracted mumps had at least one, many of them two, MMR vaccines, so they should have been protected from getting the mumps. In the pertussis outbreaks that were happening in California, we found that out that the vast majority of those children had had pertussis vaccination and had the full series. We know that in the military that there are people that have been fully vaccinated, and there have been outbreaks of rubella and measles. So we also know from the medical literature that even people who've been fully vaccinated against tetanus, that have had 4 or more tetanus shots and have antibodies levels, which would be defined by the medical literature as being protective antibody levels, still contracted full-blown tetanus, which then tells us that having an antibody doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be protected from getting the illness for which you've been vaccinated against. We use the words immunization and vaccination as though they were synonyms. They are not. Vaccination, by definition, is the act of giving a shot. And that is what vaccination really means. Immunization means that you have become immune. You do not necessarily become immune from a vaccine. In fact, there's a large body of evidence that shows that it only causes harm. It really doesn't make you immune at all. So the definition of immunity means that you have had a natural infection from a community-acquired virus or bacterial infection, but primarily viruses. And the difference being is that vaccination engages mainly one part of your immune system, which is called the Th2 side of the immune system, and it primarily engages that arm. That's why over time, when you have an antibody, it goes away. And that's why even those who believe in vaccines know that the antibodies wane, and why they are promoting now many, many, many booster shots. We know that when you have a community-acquired infection, such as measles or mumps or rubella or even influenza or chickenpox, it engages both sides of the immune system, the side that's called Th2, which creates the antibodies, the Th1 side of the equation, which engages the self-immunity that is defined by the difference between knowing who you are and where your environment stops. And those two types of the immune system go through this really nice dance when you have a real infection and you have fever and you have cytokines and you have white blood cells and you have all of these different types of portions of your immune system coming together in a dance. And that's where lifetime true immunity comes from. When you are re-exposed to a virus or re-exposed to that infection, your immune system has been fully engaged and recognizes that and says, I don't have to process that again. We've done that once. They push out a little bit of intrinsic immune system help to push that virus out of the way, and that's where true immunity comes from. When babies are born, they are by definition born immature. Their neurological system is immature. Their immune system is immature. Their lungs have to take that first deep breath in order to get surfactant and mature their lungs. So from the moment of birth and that first deep breath, there are an enormous number of cascades that have to happen in order for all of the systems to be go and to click on all of the buttons. It's like launching the space shuttle off of the pad. All of the systems have to be go. And all of these cytokines and all of these hormones and everything starts processing all at the same time. What we do to these newborns is within minutes of birth, they're exposed to latex, they're exposed to vitamin K shots, a vitamin K shot that is given almost immediately after birth, on the outside chance that a very rare blood disorder might be happening in this baby. It has 9 milligrams of benzyl alcohol, and there have been reports in the pediatric literature, particularly the Canadian pediatric literature, that thinks that it's that vitamin K shot that's given right at birth that leads these children, many of them, down the pathway into jaundice, and they have kernicterus and all these different problems because their liver is not meant to handle that big dose of alcohol as soon as they're born. Within a few more hours after birth, then we give them a hepatitis B vaccine. The first paper that came out about the hepatitis B vaccine and using that vaccine in America was based off of a study that was done in Southeast Asia, where 10% of the population of women in Southeast Asia are endemic to carrying the hepatitis B virus. That 1991 paper, in essence, said because hepatitis B is endemic in the population in Southeast Asia, and mothers there have high incidence of hepatitis B, we should probably give the hepatitis B vaccine to children in this country. It made no sense to me then. It probably makes no sense now. And so within hours, we have assaulted this brand new being that's just landed on this planet with all these systems meaning to go, and we've hit them with antibiotics in their eyes. Many times they're exposed to antibiotics coming through the birth canal. If mom has a strep B infection, they get a vitamin K shot, they get a hepatitis B vaccine, they get an exposure to latex, and now they're maybe 6 hours old. A mere 8 weeks old, 8 weeks old, 56 days of life on this planet, the baby goes in for its first well baby checkup. And at that time, they may be given up to 6 or 7 different vaccines, a DPT, which is diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis, a polio vaccine, another hepatitis B vaccine, a HIB, which is for Haemophilus influenza B, and possibly a Prevnar vaccine, which is 7 strains of strep, maybe even 13 strains of strep, all given at the same time. So it's like giving 20 or 30 vaccine antigens in about 5 or 6 shots. Each of those shots have chemicals, things like aluminum, polysorbate 80, all kinds of toxic chemicals that are causing lots of problems in immune systems. And that's at a mere 2 months of age. That process is repeated at 2 months, 4 months, 6 months. They get another big dose of vaccines at 1 year of age. So that by the time children are 1 year old, they will have had more than 70 different vaccine antigens injected in measurable amounts of chemicals. In fact, the two vaccines that have the highest amount of chemicals, in my opinion, are the MMR and the chickenpox vaccine. Both of them have milligram amounts of gelatin. The gelatin then can be injected into the body, cross the blood-brain barrier, and cause inflammation. They have inflamed brains from all these vaccines that have happened through their developmental years of life. Children get multiple doses of vaccines by the time they're 6 months of age. At about 8 months of age is where they start to get chronic ear infections. And the ear infections come, and then they get an antibiotic and another ear infection and another antibiotic. And they have disruption in their intestinal tract. Then by the time they're 1 year of age, they have their birthday party. They go in for their one-year checkup with their pediatrician, and they get another round of vaccines, and many of them, within hours, days, weeks, or months, digress into autism. The vaccines are never blamed. They always say that it's anything but. And now that we're seeing more vaccine injury in older children, children that are 9, 10, and 11 that are getting the Gardasil vaccine that's supposed to protect them from cervical cancer, these are children who were athletes, they were scholars, they were musicians, and all of a sudden they are having seizure disorders and they are becoming chronically ill. And that doesn't even include the children on the autism spectrum, where they have all of these learning disabilities, sensory integration disorders, speech delays, all of these other obvious signs of neurological and brain dysfunction. The flu is such an interesting illness that we make such a big deal about. You know, over the last few years, we had SARS, and then we had bird flu, and now we've had swine flu, and now they are quiet, and it seems to be these little peaks that there's this big pandemic that's coming. We know it's coming, coming, coming. It's anticipated. It's coming, and they plant all these things into being. I don't understand how they get away with it, quite frankly. I believe that it's an FTC violation. There is so much information out there now that says that flu shots don't work. The Cochrane Collaboration, which is a think tank organization out of Rome that does a complete analysis of all available information on an isolated topic. And several times now, they have reviewed the information on flu shots. And their conclusion is that in all three populations, children and babies starting at 6 months of age, which is where we give flu shots now, middle-aged adults that we ostensibly give the flu shots so that they don't miss work, and senior citizens because we don't want them to die if they get the flu. In all three of those populations, a flu shot is no more effective of keeping you from getting sick than just giving you a sugar pill. The data is unequivocal that flu shots don't work. And then there's all of this media propaganda that says that 36,000 people die every single year from the flu, but by their own information that is a lie. And there's about 700 people that die per year from the flu, and most of them are over the age of 80. The data shows unequivocally that vitamin D is the best way to prevent yourself from getting the flu in the winter. The science that shows that as vitamin D peaks up in the summer, influenza goes down, and as the vitamin D levels go down in the winter, particularly when you're living in the northern hemispheres, the incidence of influenza goes up. Well, to me, that's because of the change in vitamin D. I believe that influenza is around all year round. It doesn't come and go. It doesn't migrate like birds. So it doesn't come and go. It's here. So what changes is our susceptibility to that influenza virus. From the time of the very first vaccine, the smallpox vaccine that was first given in this country in 1801, it has always been a faith and a belief system that vaccines work, that vaccines are safe and they keep you from getting sick, and that if we vaccinate everybody at a very high level, it should keep the population safe from getting sick. And that the rights of the individual to get sick and go around and spread disease if they choose not to be vaccinated by any of the vaccines that are now available is wrong. And that the right of the individual needs to be subrogated to the good of the whole. And that has been one of the political debates about vaccination for 200 years. But times have changed since that argument was first instituted. At that time, there was one shot, a smallpox vaccine. Now we've got 16 different vaccines and multiple doses of them. We have the sickest population ever in terms of children and adults who are on long-term chronic diabetes medicine, other types of pharmaceutical drugs. They are already unhealthy before they are injected. The right of the individual needs to be taken into a higher elevation, because that individual person is at a much higher risk of a reaction to the vaccine than they are to having a problem if they get exposed to the illness. It's my opinion that vaccine injury can be anything from a sore arm and swelling to asthma, allergies, eczema, ADD, ADHD, cancer, insulin-dependent diabetes, and autism. Autism is, in my opinion, at the far end of what's happening in terms of brain destruction from these vaccines. But we have the most unhealthy generation of children in the history of mankind. The largest, most powerful industry in the world is the pharmaceutical industry. They have their tentacles everywhere, into lobbying in Washington, D.C., lobbying at the state organizations to get state mandates passed for vaccines on a statewide basis, to get mandates passed into schools. They have fingers into foundations, fingers into major corporations, the media. They are everywhere, protecting their turf in terms of their drug-based pharmaceutical industry.
Let me just intercede. That is a different topic, and let us continue that on an upcoming program. I thank you very much, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. I'm Gary Nall. Thank all of you for listening today. Look forward to sharing more, and go to last evening's program, the Progressive Commentary Hour, from our archives, and download a very powerful show on who buys the science that then creates the medical treatments that are so ineffective and dangerous. Have a nice day.
There are so many kinds of riches, and only one of them is gold. The wealth you miss, remember this. Worthwhile things cannot be bought or sold.
The Gary Nall Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Tabenfeld.
Radio Network, your home for progressive thinkers.
I'm Johnny Mueller of the Expat Files, living in Latin America. It's the only show of its kind that tells you exactly what it's like to live, work, and or play in Latin America. So if you're thinking about getting off that first world treadmill, or just curious about how you can live a first world lifestyle down here in Latin America for a third of what you pay up in the States, and with half the stress, like I've been doing for the last 20 years, just tune in Monday and Friday at 11 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time, or click on the archives for all my past shows at prn.fm. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
South of the border, down Mexico way.
Hello, this is best-selling author Deborah Wolf, live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Get animal insight from my world-class pet.